Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today's program is somewhat a fulcrum, balancing between the Magna Carta and Juneteenth, each 2 days fore and aft its keel. Pardon the mixed metaphors. I start with the Magna Carta. And I wrote this. This past Tuesday, June 15th, was Magna Carta Day, the Great Charter's 806th birthday. Anybody familiar with the immortal legend of Robin Hood, who robbed the rich and gave to the poor, knows about evil Prince John, and perhaps might also remember when he was King of England after the death of his brother, Richard the Lionheart, who was slain in battle as many kings were in those days of yore, that his angry barons forced John to concede a few essential rights and liberties, or they would impeach him, 13th century style. Considered the most famous document of British constitutional history, the Magna Carta was issued by King John at Runnymede under compulsion from the barons and the church on June 15, 1215. After being crowned king, John returned to his old wicked ways and incurred general acrimony from his expensive and unsuccessful foreign wars, financing them by levying heavy taxes on the baronage and peasantry, charging excessively for royal justice, quote-unquote, selling church offices to whomever had the requisite coin, and seizing property from those whose lax in taxes. In 1215, the peers of the realm rose in rebellion and, faced by irresistible wrath, John parleyed with the barons at Runnymede. After some attempts at evasion, he set his seal to the barons' demands, and the resulting document was proclaimed a charter freely granted, although its guarantees were actually extorted by the angry peerage. In reality, the charter was in most respects a reactionary document. It ensured feudal rights and privileges to only the nobility and the church, from which the king could not renege. Yet the charter definitely implies that there are laws protecting the rights of subjects and communities the king was bound to observe, and penalties if he failed to observe them. In other words, English kings and queens were no longer above the law. Historically most important were vaguely worded statements against oppression of all subjects, which later generations interpreted as guarantees of trial by jury and habeas corpus. These interpretations were not explicit in the charter, but eventually became laws of the land. The Magna Carta did not prevent civil war that year of 1215, and quite likely was a cause, nor did it end antagonism between Normans and Saxons that had festered since the invasion of 1066, but it began a sense of commonality between aristocracy and proletariat. The Magna Carta might be considered a midway point between Solon's Athenian constitution of the 6th century BC and the U.S. Constitution. With most of the land and political power in the hands of Athenian nobility, and the peasants not only losing their land but freedom as well, being sold into slavery for debts, there was a great deal of social, economic, and political stress in Athens during the late 6th century BC, or BCE, before Common Era. In desperation, Solon, a successful soldier, and what now would be considered a lawyer, was called upon all stratas of Athenian society to draw up a constitution. He made important constitutional changes on the side of humanitarian ideas and opened the city's assembly to all free men, though not women, that took another three millennia for women anywhere to have constitutional rights. He ended all borrowing in which a person's liberty might be pledged, which put an end to serfdom in Athens and its province of Attica, but not the residual slavery of Greece, which, like the rest of civilized antiquity, depended on slavery as its machinery. Solon's relatively humane code was a great contrast to the onerous code it replaced of the dictator Draco, whose name continues to personify cruel legislation on a par with the Spanish Inquisition's Torquemada of the 15th century AD, or CE, Common Era. Draco's draconian legal code was quite simple. The penalty of death was applied for even the most trivial offenses. Perhaps his single quantum reform was that murder was punished by the state, not by vendetta. Asked what made a good and orderly state, Solon answered, "When the people obey the rulers, and the rulers obey the laws." The most significant codification of law prior to Solon was that of Hammurabi, king of Babylonia in the 18th century BC. Considered one of the greatest of ancient legal codes, it was carved on a diorite column in 3,600 lines cuneiform and was discovered at the beginning of the 20th century AD in Susa and is now preserved in Paris. Hammurabi's code addresses issues such as family and business relations, labor, private property, and personal injuries, and is generally humanitarian in aspect, although one severe feature is retributive punishment of literally an eye for an eye, which, like much of the code, was drawn from earlier Sumerian and Semitic laws and provides a hard shell Ur text of punitive precedent. Ancient Mesopotamia's pioneering in law led to the introduction of writing to codify legal charters by Elamites, Urians, Hittites, Sumerians, Hebrews, Babylonians. America's code of laws is based more directly upon Roman and Iroquois law than on Hammurabi or Solon. But our Constitution is essentially the direct benefactor of English law that developed from the Magna Carta. Our ancestors, as imperfect as they were, fought a revolution and conceived a Constitution, as imperfect as it is, because they thought of the future. They knew very well that governments swallow the rights of their citizens, and that the natural inclination of authority is to concentrate and perpetuate its power by any means. They also had the foresight to recognize that the interests and problems of succeeding generations would most certainly be different than their own. Governments reflexively subvert the rights of all but its ruling classes, even in systems originated to provide rights to the governed. Constitutional laws simply make it more difficult for leaders of government to make the rest of us so completely their subjects. This current period of trauma and crisis is precisely what our ancestral revolutionaries had in mind when they set up the imperfect but earnest Constitution and its Ten Commandments of American democracy. They anticipated critical moments of great tragedy and anxiety, such as now, and realized unscrupulous persons would seize the opportunity to grasp autocratic power and dismantle the Constitution. We Yankee Doodles Come Lately commemorate the development of political rights and liberties over the centuries through displays and ceremonies around such documents and proclamations as the Magna Carta and this year's 245th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence on July 4th. And we honor France's Bastille Day of 1789 on July 14th. This past December 15th, was the 229th anniversary of the Bill of Rights, which gives constitutional rights to the common folk, and in particular, protects minorities from the tyranny of majorities. But domestic politics in the USA are becoming as severe and confrontational as during the Civil War. The cultural dialogue narrows considerably, simplified into dogma and prejudices that fault subgroups for all that appears to have gone wrong, reduced to an us or them snarl. The most clamorously vile demand their vengeful fables be legislated into political veracity. In the names of freedom and justice, both are eroded, and it becomes difficult to resist an inversion that seems irreversible. The real purpose of the American experiment is that human beings are capable of coexisting as equals, that so-called free enterprise is not one of unfair or dominating advantage. A democracy is not healthy when enormous numbers of its citizens are unemployed or underpaid, with poverty and homelessness their only prospects. Perhaps the colonial rebels who declared independence from their mother country nearly 2.5 centuries ago had their own ambitious agendas, but they revived the ancient dream of living without shackles, of determining one's own life. The most famous sentiments of the Declaration of Independence virtually shout the long thwarted desires of freedom and equality, and that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, quote, unquote. Even the infamous Robespierre could a few years afterward define democracy as a state in which the people, as sovereign, guided by laws of its own making, does for itself all it can do, and by its delegates what it cannot. And Bill Moyers wrote 2 centuries later, "Constitutional democracy is no romantic notion. It is our defense against ourselves, the one foe that can defeat us." Yet in contrast to the premise that a constitution manifestly provides a reasonable guarantee of political equality, listen to a group of workers in Sheffield, England, whose bitterness in 1741 sounds as if they were speaking about life in the U.S. today. What's the Constitution to us if we are nothing to it? A newly reconstructed elite projects a constrained interpretation of the Constitution. Its rights and privileges belong to the wealthy and propertied, its dues and obligations to everyone else. They would like to suspend the Bill of Rights and believe in what they call original intent of the framers of the Constitution, who were all white, propertied, and or mercantile males, should be its only interpretation. The endless circle of individual rights and obligations melding within collective necessities is distinctly at play despite the strangling morass of deceit, corruption, and the sinister erosion of civil rights and liberties of average Americans. Democracy incites ever-increasing numbers despite the more than usual attempts by radical right factions to disembowel it. And despite America's own callous repression of libertarian movements abroad, covertly or overtly, the U.S. is often the model of independence sought by indigenous rebels of those same liberation movements. The only true significance of the USA is its secular gospel of freedom of humanity from tyranny, inequality, and subjection. Our constitutional vow of liberty, equality, and justice for all is an obligation that we protect these basic rights and freedoms for our descendants. The famous American judge, Learned Hand, said that liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. And that was something I wrote about the Magna Carta et al. And now, by Kenneth C. Davis, Juneteenth is for everyone. some 2 months after General Robert E. Lee surrendered on April 9, 1865, effectively ending the Civil War, Major General Gordon Granger steamed into the port of Galveston, Texas, with 1,800 Union soldiers, including a contingent of United States colored troops. Granger was there to establish martial law over the westernmost state in the defeated Confederacy. On June 19th, 2 days after his arrival, and 153 years ago, Granger stood on the balcony of a building in downtown Galveston and read General Order Number 3 to the assembled crowd below. The people of Texas are informed that in accordance with the proclamation from the Executive of the United States, all slaves are free, he said. That was the first time many in the crowd had learned of the Emancipation Proclamation, which President Abraham Lincoln had issued 2.5 years before. White slaveholders had suppressed the news of the decree, freeing slaves in Confederate territory, not under Union control. We all walked down the road singing and shouting to beat the band, a Texas freedwoman recounted. Black men pitched their hats high in the muggy June air, according to another report. Men and women screamed, "We's free, we's free." Others left town in what became known as the scatter. The jubilation following Granger's announcement in Galveston moved across Texas, quickly reaching the state's 250,000 enslaved people. A year later, a spontaneous holiday called Juneteenth, formed from the words June and 19th, began to be celebrated by the newly freed people of Galveston and other parts of Texas. In 1867, Austin, the Texas state capital, saw its first Juneteenth celebration under the direction of the Freedmen's Bureau, the federal agency created to provide relief to people displaced by the Civil War. Embraced as an exuberant day of jubilee, Juneteenth combined a history lesson and a political rally with the gospel hymns and sermons of a church service. Barbecue was soon added to the mix, this being Texas, with strawberry-flavored red soda water to wash it down. In time, rodeos, baseball games, and family reunions all became part of Juneteenth traditions. As former slaveholders attempted to maintain their control, this display of freedom was often met with violence. Juneteenth revelers sought the relative safe haven of black churches. A poignant irony, given the tragedy of June 17, 2015 in Charleston, South Carolina, when 9 parishioners of historic Emmanuel Methodist Episcopal Church were murdered, including the senior pastor, Clementa C. Pinckney, by a young white man, Dylan Roof, who wanted to start a race war. Some of these Texas churches began raising money to buy land on which to mark Juneteenth. In Houston, 2 black congregations collected pennies and nickels until a 10-acre parcel was purchased for $800 in 1872 and named Emancipation Park, which is still used today. The Festival of Freedom spread across the former Confederacy in the late 19th century, and as African Americans moved north, they carried this celebration of liberation with them. As Isabel Wilkerson wrote in The Warmth of Other Suns, her prize-winning account of the Great Migration, the people from Texas took Juneteenth Day to Los Angeles, Oakland, Seattle, and other places they went. Even now, with barbecues and red soda pop, they celebrate June 19, 1865. And that was Isabel Wilkerson. Granger's order was momentous, but it was no magic bullet. Even with the ratification of the 13th Amendment in December 1865, the emancipated people of Texas and the rest of America confronted violent resistance as they attempted to claim the promise of their liberation. Any small gains came in the face of whips, guns, and lynching, followed by the well-documented decades of Jim Crow laws and Klan terror. Officially neglected, Over time, Juneteenth lost much of its resonance in the Black community, but it has enjoyed a renaissance in recent years, spurred by a revival of pride in Afro-American traditions long denied or suppressed. Juneteenth has gained official recognition, although not necessarily full legal holiday status, although a bill is in Congress. In a number of states, starting appropriately with Texas, which made Juneteenth a paid holiday for state employees in 1980. Still, 156 years after its birth, Juneteenth remains largely unacknowledged on America's national calendar. Many Americans are unaware of its existence or its roots. Sadly, that ignorance of Juneteenth reflects a deeper issue, the continued existence of two histories, Black and white, separate and unequal. Frederick Douglass voiced that fundamental divide in a memorable speech on July 4, 1852, to a majority white audience. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence, bequeathed by your fathers, is shared by you, not by me, he said. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. Juneteenth is the flip side of the Independence Day coin. A century and a half after General Granger told the enslaved people of Texas they were free, Juneteenth is viewed by many of those who are aware of it as an African-American holiday, quote unquote. That perception unfairly diminishes the fundamental significance of Juneteenth. The day should be recognized for what it is, a shared point of pride in the symbolic end of centuries of racial slavery, a crime against humanity and a great stain on America's soul. As meaningful as Independence Day itself, Juneteenth completes the circle, reaffirming life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as the rights of all, not a select few. And that was by Kenneth C. Davis. Juneteenth is for everyone. He is a historian and author of Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned, Don't Know Much About the Civil War, and most recently, The Hidden History of America at War, Untold Tales from Yorktown to Fallujah. He wrote this article for the New York Times. And Oregon is among 41 states that recognize Juneteenth as a state holiday. But Congress, having consistently refused to pass legislation to authorize Juneteenth to be a national observance, has a bill to do so right now. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Halzer-Schalk is engineer for this program. Also on June 15th, in the year American historians call the year of decision because of the many events that increased U.S. territory, North, South, and West, 1846, the United States and Britain signed the Oregon Treaty, which established the 49th parallel as the current boundary between Canada and the USA. The deadly pandemic that has plagued humanity this past dreadful year seems to be de-infestating, thanks mainly to a plethora of desperately devised vaccines. Although it has killed many millions worldwide, it has not depopulated entire habitats, as did the horrendous bubonic plague in the 14th century. The late Ed Niska, a prominent Finnish historian, and pioneer KMUN programmer of Scandinavian music, once offered a perspective of the Black Death's long-lasting exaction and depopulation of Northern Europe. Forests reclaimed farmland and villages, and wolves were seen in the outskirts of Paris, he said. Several generations after the plague, which killed two-thirds of Norway's human populace, one story of many such was of a hunter who years later shot an arrow into a bell in the middle of a resurgent Norwegian forest. He found a church amidst the trees and a bear hibernating at the altar. In one part of Norway, Niska said, a house dating from the early 19th century is the oldest in the area, 600 years after the plague had decimated the earlier settlement. Like moths and butterflies emerging from chrysalis, Americans re-enter from COVID isolation, leaving behind nearly 600,000 dead. The estimated plague deaths of a century ago in the USA, which does indeed seem a millennium in the past. Be careful as you test your newfound wings, and have a sizzling summer solstice.